Affairs Committee, and first on the agenda, and everyone has a copy of this. There's a draft there, and I learned that I have to ask permission of the committee to draft the measure. So I move the committee request a measure draft for the resolution of the Public Commission on the Legislature. Is there any discussion?
What was that?
Is there any objection?
What are we doing, could you repeat what you said?
My motion is, I move the committee request a measure draft for the resolution on the Public Commission on the Legislature. Sound good to you guys?
Sounds good, Mr.
Mayor. Right.
Great.
Yes. Yeah, I can't wait.
Seeing no objection, so done.
Not sure what that is, but go ahead on.
Okay. Thank you, Janet. Do I do that all right? We'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 120. And Janet, please.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Bill 120 was introduced at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and passed the Senate on a 27-2 vote. We routed some background information on the bill from the agency. There are a number of sections of law affected that deal with certified providers or master trustees of prearranged funeral and cemetery services, with credit service organizations, collection agencies, debt consolidating agencies, consumer finance lenders, and other statutes related to pledged loan laws. Mr. Chair, the purpose of the changes to these sections of law are to make them consistent and give the department authority to regulate more specifically and concretely the roles of these agencies and types of financial institutions. This is under the department's Finance and Corporate Securities Division, and they'll be able to walk through the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Floyd, please.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, Floyd Lanter, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. With me today is David Tapman, the Deputy Administrator for the Division. I brought him along to answer all the hard questions if you have any. I appear today to request the committee support for Senate Bill 120. The purpose of this bill is to provide the director with a standard complement of enforcement tools to ensure that our major non-depository programs, as we call them, have the tools that allow us to fully enforce relevant laws and protect our Oregonians. And generically, the non-depository programs in the division are those providers of financial services that do not rely on insured federal deposits. Janet outlined those industries to you in her overview. The tools that we're seeking are the same tools that are found in other division programs and the programs of other regulatory agencies. These tools typically include the authority to conduct investigations and examinations, require production of books and records, authority to subpoena witnesses and require production of documents, ability to take enforcement action for noncompliance, authority to administratively suspend or revoke licenses, authority to issue cease and desist orders and impose fines as necessary, and the authority to bring lawsuits in circuit court for injunctive relief and appointment of receivers. The non-deposit programs that are addressed in this proposal include our pre-need sales of funeral and cemetery services, credit service organizations, collection agencies, debt consolidators, money transmitters, consumer finance, and pawnbrokers. All seven of these different programs were adopted under different regulatory schemes at different times involving different legislative enactments. As such, the enforcement tools in each of these programs were developed in a sporadic manner. And this has resulted in challenges or difficulties in enforcing the various laws. As an example, in one program we cannot subpoena witnesses or records. In another program we're unable to take immediate action against a licensee that's going out of business. Although enforcement actions are viewed as a last resort measure and are reserved for egregious situations or those that involve a harmful pattern or practice, what this bill will do will ensure that each of our programs has a full set of tools in its enforcement toolbox and allow the division to discharge its enforcement responsibilities in a more uniform and consistent manner, thereby affording Oregonians more effective consumer protection. Now, the bill is somewhat complex and adds different enforcement tools for the different programs, but the end result would be a more uniform approach to enforcement in the division. And my written testimony provides a brief overview of the major changes to these laws. And the last page of the testimony provided has a matrix which outlines the changes and the relevant sections of the bill by the program affected. So in summary, the bill does touch on a number of programs, and on first read it may appear to be complicated and difficult to parse, but the intended result is to ensure uniform enforcement powers for the various non-deposit programs involved, and I do believe the bill does accomplish that goal. It's fee neutral. We're not aware of any opposition to the bill. Several stakeholders have written letters of support for the bill. Other stakeholders have voiced support for the bill, and I notice there are a couple signed up to testify here this afternoon as well. And I would respectfully request the committee support the bill and send it to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. I stand ready to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions? Representative Holder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one question that kind of popped into my mind looking at your matrix, where your current enforcement powers on several of these organizations, it appears you have no power over them now. I'm kind of curious who enforces those organizations now.
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, we can talk about collection agencies as an example. You're right. All we do is register these folks. We have very little authority with respect to them. There's some authority with respect to the Attorney General with regard to some of these organizations. But that is the issue. When we looked at our enforcement tools in all these areas, a lot of holes. So this bill seeks to fill those gaps and allow us to administer our programs more effectively.
Follow up. So am I correct that if you see a problem with, for example, a collection agency, you'd have to go to the Attorney General for enforcement?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, correct.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you. John Brenneman and Jim Marquis.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association, a professional trade association of collection agencies across Oregon. I'm here to support Senate Bill 120. I've had numerous conversations with the department regarding this bill. We have vetted this bill through our association, and our association fully supports the bill. Currently, under current law, the department does have the authority to revoke or suspend a license of a collection agency. But there are some things that they don't have, and they don't have the authority to do an investigation on an unlicensed collection agency and to put somebody out of business who's not licensed. It's interesting. I had an opportunity to review over 100 complaints that were filed with the Attorney General's office from last year, and a substantial number of them were on out-of-state collection agencies that held no license here. And so we view this as a good opportunity for the department to do some enforcement in that area. Also, the department, with respect to the collection agency statute, doesn't have the authority to issue a compliance order, and we think that's important. There are instances where somebody made a mistake or somebody is not following the law, and you want to make them follow the law, but you don't want to put them out of business or suspend their license. And so this gives the department an opportunity to take that action that they don't have now. So it does bring a certain amount of uniformity across the board with other regulatory activity that they're involved with. And, again, we support the bill. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, Jim? Go ahead, John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Brenneman. For the record, I represent the Oregon Funeral Directors Association. We were here a couple of months ago with a House bill that asked for a different formula for taking expenses in our master trust. The Oregon Funeral Directors runs a master trust of pre-need programs, and there are other banks and others around the state who have programs. We have testified in the Senate in support as a trade association in support of Senate Bill 120, and we know we run our trust right, but we want to make sure all the trusts are run right, and we don't have a problem at all in giving the division these added tools for making sure that they are run correctly.
Thank you, John. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, John. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 120? Seeing none, we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 120 and open a work session on Senate Bill 120.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kitts, you'll be glad to know that we handled Senate Bill 115.
I have all the faith in the world. You said Senate Bill 115 or Senate Bill 15?
Go ahead. Representative Gibbs.
Boy, I thought hell was about ready to freeze over. Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 115.
120.
120. That's what I meant to say. Okay. To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 120 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, will you call the roll, please? Somebody yell it. Shields. Mm-hmm. Shields outside. Who'd you call?
Oh, hi.
Excuse.
George is okay with it.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Shields, he should be here in a second.
Aye. That's the first one, right? Aye.
Chair Brown? Aye. Motion carried. On the consent calendar?
Sure.
Representative Shoffler moves that Senate Bill 120 be placed on the consent calendar. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 121. Janet, please.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 121 is also at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Passed the Senate on a vote of 21-1. It authorizes the director to issue a cease and desist order and to impose a civil penalty for improper conduct under franchise transactions. And it makes language changes that modernize and clarify the Oregon franchise laws. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Are you signed up on this one, too, Mike? Come right ahead.
They are.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, again, good afternoon. For the record, Floyd Lanter, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. With me is David Tabman, the Deputy Administrator for the Division, and again, to answer the more technical questions if you have some. appear today to request the committee support for Senate Bill 121, which will upgrade and update the director's enforcement authority with respect to the regulation of franchise sales, not unlike Senate Bill 120, which we just heard with respect to our non-deposit programs. Currently in this area, we're limited to civil court action to address franchise fraud or violations of state franchise law. And this bill would provide the director authority to issue cease and desist orders administratively, similar to many of the other programs within the division and programs within other agencies. This form of administrative action is widely accepted and poses no special problems or hardships. By employing the Oregon Administrative Hearing Panel, administrative hearings under this bill would be conducted by a neutral administrative law judge, ensuring fairness to all parties involved. The advantage of cease and desist authority is that it gives the agency the flexibility of tailoring the enforcement action to the specifics of the situation and bringing enforcement cases without incurring the significant costs and delay dealing with the frequent delays associated with civil litigation. Additionally, the time involved in trying a lawsuit in circuit court may result in fraudulent conduct not being stopped and additional victims, primarily small Oregon businesses, being monetarily harmed. A cease and desist order can be issued and heard by an administrative law judge in a more timely manner, ensuring that the violation can be addressed promptly. But I would point out that we view cease and desist authority as a last resort, or possibly an interim step that gets the attention of the parties involved and brings them in to talk about the issue with us. The last resort is, as Mr. Markey just pointed out on Senate Bill 120, is obviously revocation of the license. This bill also would give the director authority to impose financial penalties similar to the penalties that the director can impose in other programs, including the Oregon Mortgage Lender Law, Commodities Code, and the Securities Law. There are some other proposal changes in the bill, and those were made by legislative counsel to modernize and clarify the language of the Oregon franchise laws. They're not intended to make any substantive changes. The bill is fee neutral. We're not aware of any opposition to the bill. We have discussed it with the International Franchise Association, and they're neutral with respect to that. They represent franchises all across the country. And I would respectfully request that the committee support the bill and send it to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. Stand ready to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions?
No, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out Mr. Lanter's brother, Ken, was a public works director at Happy Valley. When I was at City Council, and he lives right around the corner from me down the road. So the Lanter family's contributing quite a bit to our community. So just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 121? Don't see any. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 121 and open a work session on Senate Bill 121. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move Senate Bill 121 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves Senate Bill 121 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, if you'd like me just to simply babble nonsense until Representative Schaffler can round up the rest of the members before we take the vote, I'm more than happy to stall out in any way.
You've managed to accommodate me in that fashion before. So.
Whether you wanted it or not.
I'd like to think it my duty.
Thank you, Representative.
On behalf of that.
Okay, everybody's in place. Linda, call the roll, please.
Representative
Colton. Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Estrada.
Aye.
Chair Graham.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I'd place Senate Bill 121 on the consent calendar.
Representative Kitts moves that Senate Bill 121 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. open the public hearing on Senate Bill 501. Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 501 was introduced by Senator Courtney and would require insurance carriers to provide a number of things in an annual report to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, including their total number of enrolled members, their total premiums, their total amount of costs for claims, their medical loss ratio, and their percentage change in average premium per member per month. They need to provide aggregate financial information for the preceding year as well. This is a report that would be submitted electronically, and it would require the agency to make the information available to the public on an internet website. It also requires the Health Insurance Reform Advisory Committee to evaluate how these reports are prepared. And, Mr. Chair, it would begin the requirement with the carrier's 2007 annual report. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Carl Lundberg, please? Morning, sir, or afternoon, sir.
Afternoon.
You're not here. Go ahead.
Representative Brown, my name is Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Insurance Division for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I don't have written testimony today on this bill, but we are in favor of the bill. It is going to enable us to collect information that is currently collected, but it's not collected in as easy a fashion. This will enable us to get the information in a more usable fashion and be able to present the information to the public. I noticed that this had a referral to budget, but we filed that there would be no cost to us. So the fiscal that we filed, it doesn't necessitate a referral unless there's some other reason that you all feel that it ought to be referred to budget. We're in favor of this bill, and we would ask you to support it and move it to the floor. If it be passed, do you have any questions that I could answer?
Any questions, Carl? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Could I have Megan Sweeney, please?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Megan Sweeney. I'm the executive director of SEIU's Oregon State Council. We work with 42,000 SEIU members in the state on joint legislative politics and legislative programs. I'm here to testify in support of SB 501. The union came to support 501 after a review of what multi-year increases we're doing in health insurance we're doing to Oregon's working families. Oregonians simply can't afford these increases. In the last 4 years, health insurance premiums are rising double-digit rates. Year after year, increases in health care costs outpace inflation and workers' wages. SEIU Local 503 represents 20,000 state employees who receive health care coverage from the Public Employee Benefit Board. Between 2000 and 2003, the most recent data available, the amount that PEB paid for inpatient services jumped 47.5%, but utilization increased just 7%. At the same time, cost per claim for outpatient services increased 30%. Oregon's businesses, Oregon citizens, and Oregon's taxpayers deserve some accountability and some answers for what's driving these health care costs. We recognize that this bill is just a small piece to a big puzzle, and if we had a silver bullet about health care costs, we wouldn't need to be here right now. But this is one silver bullet. This is one policy attempt that won't cost the state money, won't give the carriers or consumers undue administrative burden or hassle to comply with. Disclosure and accountability are the new buzzwords of healthcare, and we are considering policy options that demand hospitals to be more transparent and ask drug companies to reveal how much they spend on advertising and gifts to doctors. Insurance companies should not be exempt from those requirements. Some insurance companies spend more on health care services, and some spend more on administrative costs. Economists agree that in order for the market to function properly, consumers need accurate and full information. This bill helps give consumers the additional tools to choose between insurers, and it helps policymakers get a better handle on what is driving rate increases. DCBS reports that 2.6 million visitors went to their website in 2004, www.organinsurance.org, which was up 16% from 2003. Imagine if there was a column on the website with easy-to-access information about insurance. Now savvy consumers have to click to sites outside the Oregon Insurance Division to get a site with reams and reams of paper. If the information were presented in a user-friendly way, policymakers, benefits managers, and some members of the public will use this information. 501 also provides information we currently do not have. DCBS currently does not collect information about premiums and rate increases from large group plans. That's anything over 25 enrollees and at least 1 million Oregonians. The information collected by the Insurance Division and the National Association of Insurance Carriers is not collected by plan size. What's unique about this bill is it collects information based on three plan sizes, and it allows for a more apples-to-apples comparison of what is happening in smaller markets. We urge you to pass this bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Megan. Any questions? Representative Kitts.
Megan?
Mm-hmm.
Megan, thanks for your testimony today. You said there's no cost to the state. That's a good thing. Do the insurance companies currently provide this information?
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, they currently provide some of this information to the National Association of Insurance Carriers. What we envision, and we've talked about with the insurance carriers, is how to what they now compile is different. It varies based on carrier, and it's reams and reams and reams of paper. What we want is a 1 to 2 page document available on the web that kind of summarizes key points that's uniform across carriers. What's also different about this is we don't collect information about premium increases, and we don't collect information for plans over 25 enrollees for some of this information. So some of it is currently collected but hard to find, and some of it is new.
Can I follow up?
Follow up.
So the insurance companies don't currently provide it electronically? Is that kind of the gist of it?
You might want to ask them or ask someone from DCBS, but my understanding is they do. Some of this information is available if you click outside the Oregon Insurance site to the NAIC site. It is not broken out by size of plan, so it's aggregate data, and it doesn't have premium and premium increase. It does not also that's the difference.
Follow-up? So I want to make sure I understand this. The concerns are the rising cost of health care. I get that. It doesn't cost the state any money to do this, but you're asking the insurance companies to do stuff that they're not currently doing. I would surmise there might be a cost to the insurance companies for doing this, and I would also surmise that that's probably going to have an adverse effect on the bottom line for insurance companies, which I would think would end up raising prices to compensate for the mandates and the restrictions that this product continues to put on them. So thus, your primary concern of rising health care costs, addressing those rising costs by mandating of health insurance or anybody else to do certain things, is going to have an adverse effect and do exactly what you don't want it to do.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, we've worked with the carriers to find a way to make this as least burdensome as possible, and I think we found that way. They do have this information. I know that they know what premiums they're charging for different plans, and I know what they know the premiums they were charging last year.
Right.
This is information that, for the most part, they collect all of this information, and they worked with their actuarial staff and we changed the wording a lot based on their recommendations. Of their actual staff about what was going to be accessible for them. And so, you know, I would argue that this is information that they do have and would be easy to report.
And I would argue that while they have the information, it's going to be an incurred cost to them to provide and adhere to any mandates. And whether they're good or bad, that's what the committee has to weigh. Is this necessary? Is this good public policy? Is this a need-to-know thing? And are the benefits going to outweigh the cost? Because in the end, the consumer, whom you care about, your members, my taxpayers, you know, are going to bear that cost. So that's my concern.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. Is Lori Long here, please? Yep. Both of you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. I'm Lori Long with HealthNet, Health Plan of Oregon, here in support of Senate Bill 501A. We worked along with Regents and seven other domestic health carriers, along with our National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans, to work on a compromise with SEIU on this bill. And we think we've come to terms on something that we think is not only fairly easy for us to report, but useful to the end user. Megan mentioned to you that a lot of this information is already currently reported to the NAIC, which is the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. It's also reported to DCBS, but not available in this sort of abbreviated version that is web-based. We think this will give consumers and policymakers access to something that's easy to use, user-friendly, easy to read, and provide more financial and rate transparency. Thanks.
Thank you. You go ahead and give your testimony.
Okay. Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Pam Lally, and I'm with Regents, and we, too, are in support of the bill. And I would like to acknowledge appreciation for Megan's willingness to work with us on this bill. It's in a very different form now, as you may know, than it started at the beginning of session. And oftentimes in this building, we are allowed to be part of the problem, but we may not be invited to be part of the solution. And so I appreciate that Megan allowed us to discuss what they believed the problem to be and allowed us to participate in identifying a solution that she believes will meet the needs of her constituents and that we believe will not be overly burdensome to Representative Kitt's point for the carriers. And the information provided currently is available through our financial filings with DCBS. The difference is, as Megan has said, this will call out specific lines of information that she believes are necessary for people to make some discernment about the quality that they're getting or the value they're getting for the premium dollar. And it will be more easily accessible. The information is available today for people who want to take the time to go down and research. The difference is that we will call out certain lines. It'll be available online, and people will just be able to click a button and get that information today. So, again, we support the bill, and we would appreciate your passage of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kitts.
Will there be a cost to you folks for implementing this mandate?
Representative Kitts, Chair Brown, members of the committee. Regents believes the cost will be minimal.
Yes, is the answer.
I would say it will be yes, but it will be such a minimal cost that it's not something that's even going to be easy for us to do as a line item to tell you how much. It may take an extra hour of someone's time.
Okay. Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else here to testify on Senate Bill 501A? Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, I think as Mr. Lundberg said in his opening remarks, there is really no fiscal to the department, and we would respectfully request that you recommend that the subsequent referral to budget be taken off due to the uncertainty of that committee's existence and where that whole process is.
Might be there all summer, John.
We would respectfully make that request.
All right, thank you. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 501? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 501, and we will move on to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 462. Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 461 was introduced by the Committee on Business and Economic Development in the Senate at the request of ODS Health Plans. And it modifies insurance financial regulations for health and health care service contractors, repeals a current limitation on the amount in which a health care service contractor can invest in its subsidiaries, and permits such a contractor to make investments in their subsidiaries in accordance with current statute until January 1st, 2009, as long as the investments are based on the combined capital and surplus as of December 31st, 2004. There are additional guidelines for determining the amount of an insurer's investments. Mr. Chair, there is a statute repealed by Senate Bill 462, and you have a copy of that at your place, ORS 750-047. And, Mr. Chair, it passed the Senate on a vote of 27 to 1. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have John Jervik and Sarah Reeder, please?
Good afternoon, Chair Brown, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Reeder, here today on behalf of ODS. The ODS Companies is a multifaceted organization that provides dental, medical, and professional liability insurance products, along with a variety of business services, including dental practice management software and benefits administration. ODS is Oregon's oldest dental insurer and currently serves over 600,000 Oregonians with dental or medical insurance. ODS requested that Senate Bill 462 be drafted in response to the proposed repeal of the statute, as Janet outlined, pertaining to investments by healthcare service contractors, proposed by the Department of Consumer Business Services Insurance Division. ODS and the division have worked out the details for the proposed repeal, and Senate Bill 462 is that consensus agreement. For the record, I have submitted testimony of ODS's legal counsel, Mr. Jim Kennedy from Kennedy & Kennedy, who could not be here with us today. However, John Jervik, Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer for ODS Health Plans, is here. Just briefly, just to summarize the primary components of the legislation that were underscored by Janet, again, this is a repeal of a specific statute pertaining to healthcare service contractors and their investments in subsidiaries, and makes application of healthcare service contractors now under a more general statute, which is ORS 733. We worked very closely over the interim with the Department of Consumer and Business Services to assure that there would be an adequate transition plan for this process, as Janet outlined, that the capital and surplus and assets would be considered as of December 31st of 2004 through the transition plan up to January 1 of 2009, at which time healthcare service contractors would then be subject to ORS 733, the more general, more restrictive statute, and again, that this was an agreement that we had reached. In addition, and lastly, I would just simply say that the bill outlines a number of different specifics with respect to how those investments are made. But the one last thing I would note is that there is an amendment in Chapter 733 that speaks to compliance issues, so that we can be sure that we're minimizing or eliminating the risk for future non-compliance with this new statute. Simply, finally, just say that, that, as Janet said, this bill came unanimous out of the Senate Business Committee and near unanimous out of the Senate floor, and so we would appreciate the support of the committee today. Thank you.
Thank you. John?
Thank you, Chairman Brown, members of the committee. Thank you. John Jurevic, I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the ODS Companies. But just to reiterate what Sarah emphasized here, this was indeed a collaborative effort between our company and the DCBS. We will be under more restrictive limitations with respect to investment in subsidiaries, but we felt it was appropriate and fair that we were given adequate transition period and guidelines in this transition period.
which this bill certainly takes into consideration. There are a couple other issues that this bill does with clarifying the language under 733-630, which we think are very important. One of which applies the calculation consistently between insurance subsidiaries and non-insurance subsidiaries. Second, that it provides for the calculation so that if amounts, once they're invested, there is a calculation that can be performed so that if amounts are repatriated or returned, you're given credit for that in future investment considerations. And lastly, and importantly, it clarifies how the calculation is performed and what it sets dates and how the calculation is measured at a particular date. And with that said, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate your testimony. Thank you. Could I have Nancy Boyson and Carl Lundberg again? Hello again.
Hi, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Insurance Division for the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I have with me today Nancy Boyson, who will address you on this bill.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Nancy Boyson. I'm the Manager of the Consumer Services and Market Regulation Area for the Insurance Division of the Consumer and Business Services Department. As was mentioned, Senate Bill 462 proposes to apply healthcare service contractors the same standard of investment in subsidiaries that now apply to insurance companies. This bill replaces Senate Bill 129, which was introduced at the request of the department and addressed the same subject. Healthcare service contractors are corporations such as ODS, Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield, Kaiser Permanente, that are sponsored by a group of doctors or hospitals and accept payment for healthcare services. Healthcare service contractors generally conduct their business in a manner similar to commercial insurers, and for that reason are subject to most of the same laws that apply to commercial insurers. We want to require the equal treatment of investments in subsidiaries because the difference in the business operation of a healthcare service contractor and an insurance company doesn't warrant a difference in the limitations of the investments in subsidiaries. As Sarah had mentioned before, we worked with the healthcare service contractors during the last year to come with a solution about these issues, and that's the result for Senate Bill 462, and we ask for your support in this bill.
Any questions? Explain to me again what the difference is between a healthcare service contractor and a company that provides healthcare insurance.
A healthcare service contractor is a nonprofit corporation that is sponsored by a group of doctors or hospitals, where a commercial insurer is a for-profit corporation.
Okay. All right. That helps. Any questions? Thank you again for your testimony. Is there anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 462? Don't see anyone. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 462, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 462.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 462 to the floor of the Dupass Recommendation.
Representative Schaffler moves Senate Bill 462 to the floor at the Dupass Recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Linda, we call the roll, please.
Representative
Holliday? Aye.
Representative
Kent? Excuse.
Representative Schaffler?
Aye.
Representative
Shields? Aye.
Representative
Estimo? Aye.
Representative
Gilman? Excuse.
And Chair Brown?
Aye. Motion carries.
Would you like it on the consent calendar, Mr. Chair?
Think we can get by that one. Representative Shields would like to carry.
Oh, very good.
Well, thanks for speaking up, Chip.
I was just telling Representative Shoffler that I think I need a staff of six to figure out the details of that.
Did you see all the numbers on that?
I'll provide you with my litany of questions before the session.
Yeah, no, I do agree that it's probably one that should be explained in some possibility to the.
Thank you, Representative.
Happy to do it, Mr. Chair.
I like that tone of enthusiasm. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 573A. Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 573A was introduced at the request of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Senate vote of 23-4. The bill does have a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee. The bill does not have a fiscal impact according to the agency. We've delivered the A3 amendments, and just in the last 5 minutes we have the A4 amendments, so I'm going to pass them out, and I think the audience members, there's copies in the back. And the A4 amendments replace the what the original bill does is prohibits an insurance company from re-rating an existing customer's insurance policy based on a change in family status for a new home or a new vehicle. The amendments modify that so that it makes re-rating a customer based on a customer's history or credit history. They can't do it at a time just because of the marital status change of the customer due to death or divorce. And there's people here to explain it.
To explain them? Okay.
Thank you.
I've got a moment. Okay.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the A4s will replace the A3s. I don't think anyone's going to speak to the A3s.
No, I don't.
Thank you, Janet. Let's see, where's my... Carl, again, please. Afternoon again.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Carl Lundberg. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Insurance Division for the Department of Consumer Business Services, and I'm here today to request the committee's support on Senate Bill 573A engrossed with the proposed amendment. Legislation enacted in 2003 regulates the use of credit history and scoring by the insurance industry. That legislation provides that credit scoring information may be used only with new instances of business and prohibits insurers from using credit scores to cancel or increase rates for current policyholders. The legislation has resolved many of the problems that consumers had experienced with insurers' use of this information. Senate Bill 573A engrossed proposes to further the purpose of the 2003 legislation. The bill prohibits an insurer from re-rating a consumer or an existing policy based on the consumer's credit history when the consumer's marital status changes because of death or divorce. The A engrossed version of the bill would also prohibit re-rating when the consumer replaces a car covered by the policy or adds a car, or when the consumer replaces a residential home covered by the policy with another home. The amendment before you today, designated as A4, proposes to remove the language related to replacement or addition of a car and replacement of a home. This is because we haven't seen these problems in Oregon, and some insurers are concerned that their inclusion into the law might have anticipated consequences absent of a real problem. The bill with the A4 amendment closes a loophole. It's not clear under the current law whether an insurer may re-rate an existing policy or consumer when there is a change in marital status owing to death or divorce. Most companies have not sought to re-rate policies or consumers in this situation, but at least one major insurer had done otherwise. This change, therefore, establishes a best practice for the industry and one that most insurers already follow and will benefit consumers who are insured by the other insurers. The A4 amendment is nearly the same as the A3 amendment. The difference is that in the A3 amendment, the term consumer was used, and in the A4, the term customer is used. And the reason for that is because what the purpose of this legislation has been and what we are trying to further with this amendment to this bill and with this bill is to prevent re-rating of the customers. We're not trying to say that all consumers, you can't re-rate a consumer who you haven't had business with. And so this went through the drafting and we didn't pick up on this differentiation between consumer and customer until today, and so that's the reason for the late date of the A4 amendments as opposed to the A3 amendments, which you'd previously seen. But in all other ways, it's the same as what you had seen before. I request the support for the Senate Bill 573A engrossed with the A4 amendments and that the amended bill be passed to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shoffler.
Yeah, Chief, thank you. 2 years ago, especially, I remember there was a lot of discussion about credit ratings and criteria for basing that. And is there any data showing, from a layman's perspective, and this is just a question out of curiosity, I support the A4s in the bill, but is there any data showing, with the increasing frequency of divorce, and imagine 50 years ago, someone who got divorced, maybe I should go back 60 years or whatever, that I think may have applied them because there was probably something radically wrong. Today, increasing rate of divorce, it's people get divorced on a whim almost. Is there any data showing that someone got divorced, but when it was less frequent, was far more risk than today? I'm making myself clear.
Yes. Chair Brown, Representative Shoffler, your question, as I understand it, is there any data to support that a person who gets divorced today presents a greater risk than a person who got divorced 60 years ago?
A lesser risk.
A lesser risk. I haven't seen any of that type of data, but I also haven't looked for it.
Maybe it is a greater risk. I don't know.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But if you want, I can try and research it.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Holley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Carl, can you tell me, I noticed that in the A4 amendment and probably, I think, the A8, both amendments, actually, that the piece about replacing the motor vehicle and the residential home has been dropped out of this Senate bill. Do you know why we're doing that?
Well, the specific reason is because we were afraid that this was a matter that we thought might be a best practice issue, but yet there was some concern that if we actually put this into the law, that it would have repercussions that we didn't anticipate having, which would cause people to be re-rated or for companies not to be able to price their products according to the information that they would get through their underwriting practices. And so since we didn't have any data and we didn't have any complaints on this particular issue, we felt that it was more prudent to leave it out than it was to include it, because we couldn't demonstrate that we had consumer complaints to merit a change in the law.
Okay.
Representative Esquivel.
Yes, on this credit history thing, I've discussed this with other people that are in the insurance business, and I'm kind of curious, how did anyone ever conceive the idea that your credit rating had to do with your performance in automobile? I mean, and evidently it's not true. That's my understanding from the people that work in the industry. So could you kind of give me a little bit of an idea how that ever happened and who ever thought of that?
Well, I'm not sure, Chair Brown, Representative Esquivel, I'm not sure I can answer your question completely. Credit scoring started out in the lending industry, and it's still prevalent in the lending industry, and they use credit scores. And I don't know how they actually got to applying it to insurance, but I'm sure somebody started probably an actuary, and not to use their names in vain or anything, but they probably got to messing around with the statistics, and they came up with models which convinced decision makers in the industry that this was a predictive factor on risk. And so that's how it got to be using. It isn't used necessarily all by itself. They develop a model that's quite sophisticated, and they're all proprietary. And that's how they use it. And it's just a tool that is used by the industry. But I'm not here to defend credit scoring. We have supported the positions that the legislature has taken on this matter.
Any other questions? Carl? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. John, did you have anything on this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and Liberty Northwest, doing business as North Pacific Insurance Company. Mr. Chairman and members, we support the bill with the Dash 4 amendments, as Mr. Langberg has pointed out. I don't know that you want to get into the whole arena of credit scoring. However, I could maybe in very brief summary, simply address Representative Esquivel's question about where the industry stands on credit scoring. I think the industry as a whole supports the use of credit as an element of rating, not exclusive use of it, but as an element. Studies have been done reviewing millions and millions of policies, and there is indeed a very direct correlation. In fact, any study shows it is the most predictive factor of any single factor in predicting future loss. So it has an element to it that is used in a certain perspective in the entire insurance field. The Oregon law that was passed last session is very prescriptive. It prohibits it on renewal and the use of credit on renewal. So it's used on the first time a person comes to a company for a policy, and it can be used to try to get that person set at the most appropriate rating level in fairness to all of the other customers and where their risk factors have placed them in the progression. So it hopefully over time it's going to allow insurance to be more available to more people. Instead of saying no to people, it will be yes at this rate. And you can compete, go to other insurers, ask what would their rate be for your risk, and they would give you another rate. Historically, it's been no, we won't insure you, and you had to go to a high-risk company. And the industry has moved from that model now to a whole continuum of rating points and factors that hopefully will make it seamless and more available to all consumers. I would just conclude by saying there are people who, in some of them in the insurance field, who do not like credit scoring. I'd simply say that every new element used in rating or underwriting has been opposed by some in the industry, including the use of motor vehicle records. So let's simply stop and say we support the bill with the Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you, John. Representative Schaffler.
And I support the bill in the Dash 4 settlement. But we went round and round about this credit rating 2 years ago, and some of the things I remember were, for example, if you're not a frugal person and irresponsible with your money and don't pay your debts, you tend to be more irresponsible behind the wheel, for example. I think there's some direct correlation. The problem was if you were a woman and your husband had taken care of all this business all your life, he dies or you get divorced, now you don't even have a credit rating at all, which, and then you could be denied for that reason. Or if you paid cash all your life, all of a sudden you need an insurance policy. Irresponsible is a word, you know, that. But those are unique, rare occurrences, I think, or maybe not so rare, especially in a spouse example. But
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, and those, almost all of those situations, if not all of them, were addressed in the law. People that use cash have no hits, cannot, you know, it can't be used in a negative way. So those issues were identified and addressed last session in the bill.
And Mr. Chairman, I want to follow up. This session's coming to a close. We don't want to bring this at second.
Don't open this can of worms.
We got enough to do.
Representative Escobar.
Yeah, I was just wondering, when did that take effect?
Mr. Chairman.
Well, people pay cash. Because my mother, I couldn't get her a loan because she's paid cash for 20, 30 years.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobar, the bill that took effect last year would affect insurance purchases, not lending.
Okay.
But there are all kinds of things that were problems, and in the real estate business, you would know that perhaps if somebody went shopping for a mortgage and they had checked with 10 different companies, sometimes that information got lodged with a credit rating bureau, and it looked like people were out trying to borrow tons of money when they were shopping for one item, and those situations have now been taken into effect by those bureaus, and you can only be charged with one hit, I think, in a 30-day period. So if you're out shopping for mortgages and you're online and you're checking 10 different sources, those don't add up and create some kind of a backlash to your ability to buy insurance and that sort of thing. So most of these issues, and this one here is a tweak that the department or the division discovered, and they brought legislation forward to deal with. Thank you, and I'd like to get out of here.
Okay. Thank you, John, for it. And now we know what we're doing. Representative Schaffler, is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 573? Sean's shaking his head, and Dave's shaking his head. Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash horse to Senate Bill 573.
Let me get out of that. I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 573. Representative Schaffler.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 573.
Representative Schaffler moves the dash four amendments to Senate Bill 573. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that we rescind the referral to the House Budget Committee or Ways and Means.
Ways and Means.
I move we rescind the referral to Senate Bill 573 to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Schaffler moves that we rescind the referral to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 573 as amended to the House floor if it do pass recommendation.
Representative Schaffler moves Senate Bill 573 as amended to the floor if it do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Linda, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Would you like a consent calendar, sir, or do you think you just need some further explanation on the floor?
Are you wanting the experience, Representative Shields?
You know, I think I wouldn't mind carrying that one on the floor.
We love Representative Shields will carry the bill on the floor for it. Is there anything else for the good of the order, Janet? If not, we are adjourned.
Tomorrow after floor session, we meet.
On my bill.